Everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Melissa Nelson. She is an ecologist, a media maker, and a scholar activist. She's also a professor at the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. And she'll be coming on in a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news. Some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. I just want to share, my sadness over another young Black man being shot just by, driving his car and being pulled over, having an air freshener hanging from his car rear view window or rear view mirror. And it's just so heartbreaking. I'm just so upset about it. And I just felt like I needed to share that with all of you. I'm sure everyone listening here shares that feeling. And, whenever we can show our solidarity with Black Lives Matter and with Indigenous people and with people of color or, gay, Black, whatever, we just need to embrace everybody. And we really need to come together as a country. So I just wanted to voice that because it's been in the news and it's just so, so disturbing. I also want to let people know that I am looking for interns this summer. I will be back to doing my garden. Last summer, I did it almost by myself. I had a few volunteers, but it was really hard to do it all by myself. So if anyone's interested in learning about organic gardening, also about vegan cooking, because we will be doing a lot of cooking, please reach out to me either through my email or my cell phone. Both are available on my website. And I am flexible as to hours. I try to get a couple people to help so that no one is ever in the garden working alone. So we all kind of work together in partnership. I want to encourage everybody to become activists, like always. There's always things that I share on my newsletter of ways that you can take action. And as most of you know, I'm on the board of NOFA, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And they've been really pushing to try to help pass this soil health bill in New York State. And I have links on my website for you to get in touch with your representatives, both in the Assembly and the Senate, and ask them to support the Soil Health and Climate Resiliency Act. And this is a bill that's going to be under the auspices of the Soil and Water Conservation Committee, but it will assist farmers in improving the health of their soil by establishing a climate resilient farming program and provide matching grants to fund these projects, which will reduce methane emissions, implement water management systems on farmland, and encourage soil health and resiliency. And it benefits, of course, all of our organic farmers as well as conventional farmers, and it benefits all of us who like to eat local food. So please reach out to your representatives and ask them to support this bill, sponsor it, or at least agree to vote on it. And then also, I've been talking constantly about our plastic problem. We all know that we have a plastic problem. And Greenpeace just came out with a short little video that just highlights Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Nestle and how we're trying to put pressure on these big corporations to lead the effort in ridding our society of single-use plastic. They are, in bed with the biotech companies or the fossil fuel companies. And, last week I actually wrote about food companies and how they're in cahoots with diet companies. These junk food companies have bought up diet companies so that they can make money on the junk food they sell to you, and then they can make money on you trying to get thin from all the weight that you've gained from the junky food you've eaten. Well, the same is true with, you know, bottle companies, you know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Nestle, they're in bed with fossil fuel companies. And, you know, there's always these connections. You know, one of the things I love to do is trying to help people make those connections and see where big corporations are invested in another side that you don't see. And we really need to, you know, kind of undo this lobbying. Citizens United certainly didn't help the process. But anyway, take a look at this video that I have online that Greenpeace put out. And please sign on to Greenpeace's letter to these corporate polluters and ask them to, you know, be a leader. You know, we have a problem. Everyone knows we have a problem. And they have to come up with a solution, whether it's going back to glass bottles, whether it's recyclable bottles, you know, whether you can bring your bottles into the supermarket and, you know, get bulk soda. Although the truth is we should all stop drinking soda. Nobody should be drinking that stuff. But as we all know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Nestle also are bottling water. So even those bottles of water, I mean, we easily can go to stainless steel bottles and recycle, you know, and refill them that way. And that would be a much better solution. So think about that. And then I also wanted to share with you my fear about the GMO mosquitoes. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but a company called Oxitec, which is a British biotech corporation, they have developed a GMO mosquito, and they are getting ready to release millions of these GMO mosquitoes in both Florida and Texas. There is no environmental impact statement done. There's no endangered species assessment or any study on human health impacts. However, they have permission to release these mosquitoes with the hope of that these mosquitoes will mate with wild mosquitoes and then produce offspring where the females die in the larval stage. You know, I don't like mosquito bites either, honestly. I could do without mosquitoes, but they certainly have a position here on the planet. They're here for a reason. And releasing GMO mosquitoes just does not sound like a good solution, especially without studies being done on the human health impacts or the environmental impact statement. So I have a petition you can sign, and I really encourage you all to do that. You know, this is just the beginning. We've all heard about the GMO salmon that they're doing, and before we know it, everything's going to be genetically modified, and it is not good. You know, I mean, they, you know, there is enough studies out there to raise question as to the safety of this. And I really, you know, trust in nature much more than I trust in genetic modification. And that's different than farmers, you know, cross-pollinating two different species to try to get a plant that's, you know, more fungus resistant or more drought resistant. That's different than genetic modification, where they actually splice the DNA of BT or a pesticide into the DNA of the seed. That's a very different thing. So please check that out. And then I also just want to, you know, salute the Biden's American Rescue Plan. You know, he's allocated another $750 million for Older Americans Act. And that's just, you know, makes me so happy, because during the pandemic, we have heard about all the food insecurity. So many people are hurting, and seniors are, you know, especially vulnerable. You know, they can't get out. They're afraid of, you know, they were the most vulnerable with the pandemic. And so they were locked in their homes, and many of them depended on programs like Meals on Wheels that just had to stop during this pandemic, or, you know, or rev up to accommodate all the extra people that needed meals. So it was really, really hard. And I'm just really happy to hear that they are going to be getting the funding that they need. And now I want to share with all of you my recipe for this week. I made a delicious roasted tofu with cannellini beans and green olives. And it was inspired by a recipe I saw. I'm not sure if it was through Bon Appetit or New York Times, but it was a recipe. It was cannellini beans and green olives over a fish. And of course, fish has its own flavor. Tofu, as many of you know, has no flavor of its own. And so you really need to give it flavor. And so I had to adjust the recipe quite a bit in order to saute the bean mixture and give it enough flavor so that when the tofu's cooking in this bean mixture, the tofu takes on the flavor. And it really worked and it was just so great. So I want to share that with you. This is good for about 6 servings. I used 1.5 blocks of tofu, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 Spanish onion chopped, 1 red onion chopped, 2 cloves garlic chopped, 2 15-ounce cans cannellini beans, which are white kidney beans, basically, 1/2 cup of Castelvetrano olives, pitted and then just torn. And those olives are delicious. I mean, you can use other kinds of green olives if you'd like, but these olives are really quite special. I couldn't find them pitted, actually. So I actually had to pit them myself, which took a bit of time, but I have one of those cherry pitters. So it works with olives too. So it worked. 1 can of fire roasted tomatoes. And I used the can that I get at Trader Joe's. So it already has some chili in it. So it had a little spice to it. If you don't have that, you can just use regular fire roasted tomatoes and add a little red pepper flake, like 1/4 teaspoon of red pepper flake. 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 1 teaspoon of dried oregano, 1 tablespoon of fresh tarragon chopped. And that's because I had the tarragon in the house. If you don't have fresh tarragon, you can use dried tarragon just fine. And I'd use 1 teaspoon of the dried. 1 tablespoon of tomato paste, 1/2 cup of white wine, 2 scallions diced, and 1/4 cup of chopped Italian parsley. You're gonna start by preheating the oven to 300 degrees. Cut the tofu into slices about 1/2 inch thick and then into triangles. Press the pieces between 2 dish towels to absorb the water. Then line a cookie sheet with some parchment paper and lightly spray it with some oil, whether you use canola oil, coconut oil, olive oil, it doesn't really matter. But you're gonna lay the tofu slices out on the parchment paper and bake them for about 10 to 15 minutes until they start getting a crust on them, a little golden brown. And that just, will help with the texture. So it will absorb the flavor, but not be mushy. So meanwhile, while that's cooking in the oven, you're going to saute the onions and garlic in some olive oil, add the tomato paste and cook for a few minutes. Then add the white wine, the beans, the oregano, the tarragon, the olives, the fire roasted tomatoes, and the salt and pepper. And just let that cook down for a little bit. You're going to cover the bottom of a shallow casserole pan with about 1.5 cups of this bean mixture. Place the tofu triangles on top, cover with the remaining bean mixture, then sprinkle the scallions and the 1/4 cup of chopped parsley on top. Although I held back like 1 tablespoon so you have a little chopped parsley as garnish after you plate it. And roast it for 20 to 30 minutes. And that's it. It just took on such delicious flavor and I served it with some brown rice. You can serve it with brown rice or a little pasta and a green vegetable and you have a quick weekday meal. I mean, it came together in 20 minutes. It was just, well, actually, I guess a little longer, 30 minutes because it was in the oven for 20 minutes, but it was great. While it's in the oven, I'm cleaning up and then, you're sitting down to dinner and you're all ready to go. So that was just really great. So if you make the recipe, let me know. I love feedback. I want to know if you adjusted it, if you did anything different. Please share that with me. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, Melissa Nelson. She is an ecologist, media maker, and scholar activist. She is a professor of Indigenous Sustainability in the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Before joining ASU, she served as a professor of American Indian Studies at San Francisco State University. She is a transdisciplinary and community-based scholar dedicated to Indigenous rights and sustainable lifewise. Melissa advocates for Indigenous peoples in higher education, nonprofits, and philanthropy, and focuses on food sovereignty and land stewardship. Melissa is president and long-term leader of the Cultural Conservancy. And I first learned of Melissa's work when she joined the panel discussion following Sanjay Rawal's film Gather. And I knew right then that I wanted to have her on my show and share her wisdom with all of you. So Melissa, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Bhavani. It's a pleasure to be on this radio show with you. And Bujun and Dinwe Maganatug, greeting relatives to all of you out there on Turtle Island in North America and beyond. So happy to be here with you.
Wonderful. So I always love to start by asking my guests first to just tell us a little bit about your background and your work and how you came to where you are today.
Yes, well, thank you. There's a few different threads, I think, that has led me to this work that I'm so passionate about. One is my mixed race heritage. My mom is Native American, born and raised on the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Indian Reservation, and my dad is Norwegian, a Norwegian settler family, both from North Dakota in the Turtle Mountains, and they were both farming people. So farming is really in my blood and in my heritage. Of course, from my mom's Native side, Anishinaabe Cree Métis, also known as Chippewa or Ojibwe, were more hunter-gatherers, but also gardeners and farmers. And then my dad, many generations of Norwegian settler farmers. So I grew up in Northern California, very rurally, and we did a lot of subsistence farming, gardening. My dad hunted deer. We caught salmon out of the Eel River. We gathered seaweed and seafood from the Pacific Ocean. And I just thought that was normal. You know, this is in the 70s. And so when I, you know, left my home and left that rural lifestyle for the city, and I just saw there was a very different relationship to food. People didn't know where their food came from. and I just felt like, wow, there needs to be a lot more education about where food comes from, the sacrifice of plants and animals, and the quality of the food. And I didn't even know really what fast food was until I was about 15, 16. And I tried it and was just like, oh, that's awful. And I actually got sick, which was kind of a blessing in disguise because I just never touched it again. My mom always cooked our meals pretty much from scratch. So I think that made me realize how privileged I was in a way, but it was not out of privilege. It was out of kind of low income necessity. You just had to, you know, make your own food and grow your own food as much as you could. So that's a big part of my background. Also, growing up on the Eel River and up in the beautiful redwoods, I was also privileged to see, you know, natural ecosystems that were pretty healthy. I mean, the logging industry was already wreaking havoc on the redwood forests and the timber wars. And, you know, the salmon populations were already pretty decimated by those unsustainable logging practices and silt and overharvesting. So it was by no means idyllic at all. It had been pretty impacted by centuries of, you know, colonial extraction. But still, compared to other places, I was like, wow, you know, this is important to protect these places. And then always having kind of an indigenous sensibility, certainly through my mom, I knew the California Native communities had a very deep and different relationship to the land than settlers. Even as a Native person, a mixed race person, I'm not native to California. So I've always looked to the first peoples of the land where I live as really the original stewards and caretakers. So that really led me to the work of the Cultural Conservancy and studying both ecology and indigenous studies to really bring back together people and place or land and culture.
Mm-hmm. And could you share with us, you said your mom cooked from scratch most of your meals. What kind of diet were you raised on?
What
kind of food did you eat?
You know, we had a fairly typical, quote, American diet at the time. My dad and my brother loved meat, but we had a farm, or we had access to farms. So my dad and brother raised and, you know, slaughtered all kinds of animals, from chickens to cows, and but because I witnessed rabbits, geese, ducks, you name it, because I witnessed and actually participated in that, deer, elk, I became a vegetarian, because I saw to eat an animal is a big deal. And so my mom and I really were the gardeners, and my dad and my brother were more of the hunters and the fisher. Mm-hmm. I loved fish. We had salmon and trout, but we had big gardens with red potatoes and chard and broccoli and cauliflower and salads and rice. We loved and ate a lot of rice, was our main starch, potato and rice, I would say. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of green beans. And it's really a hot, good growing season inland to where I grew up, and so we could grow pretty much any vegetable. We also had a fruit orchard, and their mom and dad were really smart to buy an old property that had very mature fruit trees. So we had Bartlett pears, three types of plums, two types of peaches, a cherry tree that had been grafted with four types of cherries on it, like wow. Just an old grandma cherry tree. Prune plums, apples, three different varieties of apples, wild grapes, persimmons.
Wow.
Yeah. So my mom.
So jealous. We can't have that here in New York.
Oh man. And so we would can, you know, there was so much fruit. We would can the fruit and some of the vegetables as well. And so that was really a treat to be able to eat fruit, you know, year round, because it's cold, wet winters up there and nothing like New York, but still damp. When I grew up, we had really wet winters up there. It's the beginning of the Pacific Northwest and the temperate rainforest in Mendocino and Humboldt County. And having that fruit, you know, canned peaches and apples and such, applesauce in the wintertime was really great. So mm-hmm. I always wanted to get back to that. And here, you know, full circle, we often come back to that. Now the Cultural Conservancy has been farming at Indian Valley Organic Farm and Garden in partnership with College of Marin, a local community college, where our nonprofit has been farming Three Sisters, corns, beans, squash, and other Native American food crops for about 8 years here in the North Bay, about 25 miles north of San Francisco. And so we've been having a wonderful time kind of reinvigorating our love for gardening and plants and ethnobotany and seed saving and growing food and sharing that with community and doing that together. And then we had the good fortune where we were offered some land as kind of a land reparations. We did end up purchasing it at half price, but an elder lady wanted to return her land to a Native American intertribal organization. Oh. And we were so lucky. So now we're planning like 5-acre farm and a more of a production farm. And that's been very exciting. And we do that, of course, with the wisdom and guidance of master farmers, from organic farmers, permaculture design specialists, but really going back to the roots of Native American agriculture. And many of the great farmers are from the Pueblo communities, from New Mexico, Arizona area, because they are long-term farmers. Also, we've had many good farm teachings from the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations, Iroquois from your area, upstate New York, who are master farmers going way, way back. With the domestic corn, beans, squash, tobacco, potatoes, sunflower. So many of the Native American food crops. So that's what we're able to grow and teach it with other folks. And I find that a lot of young people these days are really kind of what we say, hungry for ancestral foods and hungry to like get their hands in the dirt and relearn how to grow food again. It's such a healing act, and it's also a radical act. It's a political act to step out of the corporate economy and grow your own food.
It is. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in the teaching that I do, you know, one of the ways that I can inspire young people to want to take that up is to kind of point out when, you know, when I was talking about connecting the dots, when you let them know how they're being manipulated by these big corporations and that, you know, they think they have food choice and they really don't have food choice. You know, you got to get them pissed off so exactly. that they want to take the power into their own hands, because, you know, we have so little choice. I mean, you go into a supermarket and it looks like, oh my God, we have all this choice. But if you really get down to it, there's like five big food corporations that own all the different companies. And right, they're big monopolies and they buy up the small guys. You know, even the small organic guys who start with this altruistic vision end up selling out to, you know, Nestle or whoever, and right. and it gets changed, you know, so.
Exactly. So we really work to try to maintain those diverse food crops, those heirloom varieties, because they are endangered, because the pressure for monocultures and genetic modification and pesticides, and it takes work to resist big agriculture. There's no doubt about it. And but, you know, just doing small scale polycultural gardens like you do and teach, I feel is so empowering and so inspiring on multiple levels. And mm-hmm. like I said, I find that a lot of young people are really excited and interested yeah. in this area. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm finding that too. So right now, you know, we hear so much about permaculture, and it seems to me like the roots of permaculture really are indigenous native traditions. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Even Bill Mollison, who's often called the grandfather of the permaculture movement, if you look at his early writings, he said, too, if you want to learn farming, you look at how indigenous peoples tended the land.
Yeah.
But it somehow got lost. And, you know, it seems that kind of the Western consumer colonial mindset just always wants to take credit for things. We reinvented this, or even like the Gaia hypothesis, the earth is a living organism. You know, we're like, duh. And there's often things that come around, but people have to learn them on their own. But, you know, some people would say that permaculture was even really co-opted or stolen or appropriated from native knowledge and turned mm-hmm. into kind of a whitewashed agriculture. I don't really go that far, because it's not that productive. If there's outright theft of native knowledge, that has to be addressed, and that's, you know, unethical and wrong, and there needs to be some kind of justice around that. But all peoples farmed, you know, all peoples yeah. around the globe have been putting seeds in the ground and paying attention to what grows better, what they taste better, what they like to eat, and doing some form of horticulture or agriculture. So it is a part of our common collective heritage. And yet it's true, indigenous peoples have been doing it for a very, very long time. And it's even embedded in our creation stories and our migration stories. But it's not the type of agriculture that we often think of, because it's polycultural, it's perennials, it's not just annuals. It looks kind of messy. It looks more natural. They don't look like the types of crops, you know, in linear lines that the early settlers wanted to see, or that they brought here to North America, mm-hmm. or what we call Turtle Island. So there's some big debates right now in regenerative agriculture, permaculture, indigenous agriculture, and some folks are really digging in their heels and making a big, making a big statement and really trying to get the recognition that native science deserves, because our knowledge of plants in the land, it's not just quaint folklore, it's science. It's based on generations of observation and trial and error and experimentation, mm-hmm. just like all science. But sadly, it often gets, you know, denigrated as this kind of superstitious or folkloric or cartoonish, or I don't know, it gets turned into something weird. And, you know, it's time that native knowledge and native science, especially about gardening and plants, gets the recognition it deserves as science. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've done, you know, a little bit of studying with of biodynamics, mm-hmm. you know, where they actually, you know, take into consideration when to plant, you know, based on the stars and the moon and, yes, you know, the different astrological cycles. Mm-hmm. Is native farming similar to that?
Very similar in terms of being very connected to the moon cycles. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, the moon cycles are critical. Obviously, the seasons, when certain constellations show up in the star in the sky, then you know it's time to either plant or to harvest. Yeah, whether you're, you know, Hawaiian taro farmers in the Pacific Ocean, or you're, you know, Quechua farmers in the Andes of Peru, or whether you're Pueblo farmers in the middle of New Mexico, absolutely looking to the stars and especially the moon cycles really determines a lot of the agricultural cycle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I thought so. Mm-hmm. So a lot of your food, a lot of your work focuses on food. Can you share with us, you know, where that comes from and what it means to eat green?
Yes. So I think I shared a little bit where it comes from. I'm also, you know, maybe lucky. I have a really good sense of smell and taste. Like I eat really slowly. We used to be neighbors with this 85-year-old elder, and she used to eat really slow, and everyone would get up and leave, and I would sit there and eat really slow with her and listen to her stories of the old times. And it was good training for, you know, slow food, basically. So I learned slow food from Carrie Vaughn, this really wonderful elder who had California native heritage, Wailaki. Anyway, so I think it came from that, but, you know, being an ecologist focusing on plants and animals and ecosystem processes was absent people. And then if you want to study Native American studies or really focus on people, you don't really talk about the environment as much, you know, in higher education, academia, media, there's always this separation, either you're a people person or kind of a nature person. It's a really artificial boundary, right? It's a really ridiculous division. And I always wanted to really keep bringing them together in myself and observe that in my communities, especially Native communities. There's just absolutely no separation between humans and the environment. It's just not existent really traditionally. And so food is the one area we have to eat at least once a day, you know, at least a few times a day. Everyone eats. Most people, not all people, most people love to eat. It's pleasurable. It's nutritious. It can be healing. We believe food is medicine. And it's the most intimate way we interact with the environment besides breathing. Breathing is a little ephemeral, breath, you know, and air. We don't see it. So we can't live without breath, most significantly, and water. But they're a little ephemeral, and food is so pleasurable and the diversity of it. So we eat our landscape every day. Enrique Somon, a great Rarámuri ethnobotanist and dear friend and colleague, wrote a book called Eating the Landscape. And it's such a great concept, because when we think of going to a grocery store or going to a restaurant and sitting down to a meal, we don't often realize we are eating the landscape, right? We are eating the environment, and, you know, not in a hopefully overly consumptive and destructive way, but in a way that actually helps heal ourselves and heal the landscape. So I see food as like the perfect nexus of nature and culture, because we have a tangible example of the environment every day. I tend to eat more plant-based and eat a lot of plants, but whether you eat plants or fish or meat, seafood, you know, you're literally eating organisms and beings that come from ecosystems and landscapes. So it reminds us too of the profound link between environmental health and human health. And we've seen them both deteriorate with the Industrial Revolution and agribusiness and pesticides and monocropping and fast food. You know, there's a direct correlation between the industrialization of our food systems and the increase in diabetes and other nutritionally related diseases. And so now we've kind of reached a point where a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, like I said, I don't have any choices. You know, my ancestors ate 100 varieties of corn. I go to the supermarket, there's 2 varieties of corn. I want to eat those old varieties of corn that were not just bred for sugar, but actually have trace minerals and other nutrients in them. And they taste better as well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I really focused on food as the nexus of the environment and human health and also cultural expression, because it's a religious and spiritual act as well. If you look at any ceremony, a birth, a death, a marriage, a rite of passage, you know, from any culture, any religion, food is involved, right? Food is involved. And so I think food really encapsulates science, art, religion, ecology, and humanity.
I'm with you. I love it. It brings all of my passions together. So
me too. It brings it all together. And it's delicious. And it's pleasurable.
and it brings people together under a communal table. I mean, sharing bread is, you know,
that's right.
A basic thing. And I love it. So I know, you know, we've all heard that, you know, communities, you know, Black, Indigenous communities really were more vulnerable to this year's pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about some of the issues and obstacles to health in the communities you serve and why the pandemic had such a devastating effect on the Indigenous communities?
Yes, I mean, that is such an important and deep issue. Basically due to, you know, 500 years of colonization since Columbus came to this land, Indigenous people have been suffering from what we call the disease of displacement, right? Being and attempted genocide. I mean, many, many presidents and governors of our early states and colonies, their first laws were to proclaim war against the native peoples and attempted genocide. And then, of course, when they started bringing over Africans for the slave trade, you know, just horrific violations of human rights, horrific abuses of religious power to dominate and enslave others. So there is something that we call the soul wound. Actually, Eduardo Duran, a famous Apache psychologist, wrote a powerful book called Healing the Soul Wound. And he talks about the historical trauma and the impacts on Native peoples from early colonial times to modern times with ongoing settler colonialism. And so, you know, you're removed from your lands, your families are massacred, you're herded up like cattle to these tiny little reservations with the worst land where you can't grow your food, you can't gather your natural diet, you're forced to eat government rations food, if you're lucky. There were many starvations that happened in the early reservation period in the 1850s, even with my Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota in the 1880s, over 100 people, you know, they just starved. It was a horrible winter and they couldn't hunt their buffalo, they couldn't farm on their land, they were cut off from everything. And so then, you know, the War Department, which is who used to manage Indian reservations before the Department of Interior was created, it was the War Department. They, quote, managed, you know, these enclosed, really like prisons in a way, Native reservations. They would then give out their rations, their leftover rations of their war foods, which was like canned meat, rancid flour, powdered milk, and most Native Americans never ate dairy. We didn't have domesticated animals really. So then had to start eating dairy, and a lot of Africans as well, and African Americans. So many are lactose intolerant, and yet the only thing you're given is, you know, white flour, white sugar, and white powdered milk. And so, you know, the ingenuity of our people put that all together and made kind of a bread that we call fry bread, which is kind of controversial. It was a survival food, though, for most Native Americans to just kind of put together these rations. And then when they could add their fresh greens in the spring or add a little buffalo meat or deer meat when they can have that. So this led to decades and really, you know, a century of what we call nutritional racism, where you were not able to eat your traditional foods and you were forced to eat a foreign food that was completely foreign to the genetics and to the cultures. And you couple that with the depression, trauma of genocide and wars and seeing your families die, and then also the epidemics from, you know, smallpox and various viruses that wreaked havoc on the early Native American population. You have a lot of trauma and depression from that. And you couple that with those nutritional deficiencies. There's been a lot of health problems in Indian country that is imposed and is a remnant or artifact from that. And it's ongoing. Many reservations still to this day in 2021 don't have access to, you know, supermarkets or to running water or to electricity, don't have refrigeration. And so they often don't have access to their foods. They can't hunt and gather on their traditional lands. It's a national park or it's protected or it's a condominium complex. So it's been very difficult for Native people to revitalize their traditional health. And so that has weakened the immune system. And then also enforced poverty, which means families have to live in small reservation homes or off reservation and, you know, small homes because of enforced poverty. And so you have 10 people living in a small home. And also with COVID, you know, it spreads through the breath in crowded conditions. So the poverty, the nutritional racism, and then the crowded conditions and the lack of PPE equipment during the early part of COVID all led to just a horrible, horrible impact on many beloved Native elders who have been lost this past year to the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. As a white woman, it's like I'm so embarrassed by our country and the way that we've treated Indigenous people and Black people. It's just, you know, it's just horrible, and you feel powerless. You know, I am as active as I can be, but you know, it's I hear the same thing when you talk about the soul wound. You know, in the Black communities, they have that too. You know, and historical trauma
and Asian Americans with being early, also kind of like indentured servants with you know, the railroads and mining and you know, all the early immigrants that were brown people of color. You know, were treated horribly and kind of like slave labor, really, and carry this soul wound. And they're all unique, but there's some common elements, certainly, with being a victim of that kind of racism and oppression. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of healing that needs to be done. And, you know, there's a lot of solutions out there as well. But I, Bhavani, really just thank you for opening up space on your radio show to even have these conversations.
Yeah.
Many people are not even aware of this history, and they don't see the, you know, entangled roots of how it's all connected and leads to poverty and to health disparities today, because people say, oh, that was a long time ago. You know, how does that impact us today? But that history, those were our roots, and they've never been reckoned with. They've never really at a national level, like in small pockets they have, but not on a national level. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It is so important for us to have these conversations.
Yes, it is.
You know, I mean, I know, you know, we've started a tradition of, you know, for Thanksgiving of, you know, recognizing the land that we're on, you know, as being Indigenous land. And, you know, Thanksgiving is not what we were taught Thanksgiving was, you know, and, you know, and I was shocked to actually find that even today, you know, that there's two different sets of textbooks that come, you know, there's the Texas textbooks and the California textbooks, the yes. same textbooks with the same name, the same publisher, and they have different history in there. Different. I mean, how is that allowed? It's, that's, you know, right. And probably none of them are have the real history, you know, it's still through a white man's eye.
Yes, still watered down. Yeah.
Anyway, before we, I don't want to run out of time. I want to hear about the work you're doing at the Cultural Conservancy, because you're really bringing so much of this work and this education to the forefront through this organization. So can you tell my listeners about
it? Yes, well, thank you. So the Cultural Conservancy is a Native-led Indigenous rights organization based in San Francisco, but it has statewide, local, regional, national, and international programs. We work to protect and revitalize Indigenous communities and their ancestral lands. So embedded in our mission is always the link between environmental protection and cultural revitalization for Indigenous people and Indigenous rights. And again, because of all those wonderful aspects of food that we brought up, food brings us together. And so we've really focused a lot of our work around Native foodways. And we call it foodways because it's not just about nutrition and amino acids and fatty acids and carbohydrates, right? We like all those. But for us, food is so much more connected to cultural values of generosity. You know, like you look at an apple tree, look at how many apples it gives, right? If it's a good year, so much. So seeds and nature is about abundance and sharing and the redistribution of wealth. And so our foodways program is really about those principles. Like I mentioned, we grow food at about a quarter acre. We're part of a partnership, a 5-acre farm at the Indian Valley Organic Farm and Garden, where we've been growing corns, beans, squash, potatoes, tomatoes, Cherokee tomatoes, tobacco, sacred herbs and medicines, different sages, hummingbird and pollinator plants. And then we grow all the brassicas that people love for, you know, nutrition and easy, good vegetables to cook, like broccoli and cauliflower and kale and chard. We also grew some quinoa and some other South American seed plants. It did really well there. And then we sell at a little farm stand, and we have an urban Indian food justice kind of food redistribution program where we deliver boxes to Native American health centers, American Indian Child Resource Centers, other Native community centers to redistribute that food to families so that they have access to healthy organic vegetables. Out of the success of that program, we also have an annual planting event. Usually around this time, we're going to have to not do it in person again because of COVID, but we usually have 100 to 200 people at our spring planting days. It's just so fun. We do the traditional Three Sisters mounds of corn, then later we do the beans and the squash, and then we do some row crops as well. We also have an ethnobotanical area with willow and sage and elderberry and California native plants that are medicine and craft and used for California native cultural practices like basket weaving or instruments or medicine making. Mm-hmm. And that has, and then we have a harvest festival at the end of the year where everyone gets to come and families come and they see that little corn seed that they put in a mound is now like a 15-foot corn crop. They get to take off the cobs and, you know, harvest and save the seed. Everyone takes seed home. We save seed for the next generation and to redistribute. And then we grind it up. We grow Iroquois white corn that was a gift to us from the Seneca people, the Bray family, that is a dent corn and makes beautiful flour for many different purposes, corn flour. And more recently, we have a place called Heron Shadow that we are creating into an Indigenous learning center and a biocultural heritage oasis up in Sonoma County on the ancestral lands of the Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo. And that is land we own ourselves. And we are really learning to be good land stewards, honoring traditional ecological knowledge. And we're going to do large scale production farm there. And we also inherited a beautiful orchard of Gravenstein apples, black walnuts, persimmons, peaches, and plums. And we also just planted quite a few others. And that's going to be more of an intensive place to really study and learn and teach about indigenous agriculture.
And where did you say that was? I'm sorry.
That's outside of Santa Rosa, California, up in Sonoma County. About 60 miles north of San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's a beautiful area. We're kind of in the middle of wine country, but really good fertile ground for growing food, a great climate. So we are in the planning and development stages for that right now. We have a native land campaign. We're putting solar panels and water storage systems. We're making really a native sustainable eco village.
Nice. And so who do you get to do the farming and do the work? When you have that much land, it takes a lot of work.
We have a team of about 15 people, and we have ongoing interns and volunteers. So we have a pretty robust group of young people who are leading the effort and the main, drivers and labor, if you will. And because of COVID, we've been really short staffed. Usually we have interns and a whole volunteer crew. And now that a lot of people are getting vaccinated and we're outdoors, farming is outdoors,
right?
Masked up 6 to 10 feet apart. So we're just now, in fact, today they put up a greenhouse. So there was a whole crew there today putting up a greenhouse. So that's pretty exciting.
Lovely.
We need to raise more money for our nonprofit. We need to hire more staff and more crew. And we also plan to, because I'm in higher education, work with a lot of students too, with community service learning.
So if any of my listeners want to donate, where do they go to the website?
They can go to the Cultural Conservancy's website, nativeland.org, www.nativeland.org.
I'll share that on my website too for everybody.
Yep. And then the Heron Shadow, there's a page there. You can learn all about our new farm, and then you can look at our Native Foodways program. But there's a donate button right from the homepage of the Cultural Conservancy at nativeland.org.
Great. I'll share that. So I was on your website and they talk about ancestral medicine that you're growing. And one of them is tobacco. And of course, my sense of tobacco is, all bad. So can you share how tobacco is used as medicine?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think tobacco is such a great teacher about what happens when you take a sacred medicine, commodify it, adulterate it, capitalize on it, and then it becomes a harmful addiction and something that's very toxic. So, there's that famous quote in ethnobotany that, what's the difference between a medicine, a food, and a poison? Dosage. Right. Uh-huh. A little like the homeopathic. Sometimes a little bit of something is good, a little too much, it can be toxic.
Right.
So tobacco is a traditional medicine of Native Americans. We are the originators of tobacco. There's dozens of indigenous native species throughout North America. Some are more spicy, some are more strong, and they were almost always used ceremonially, sometimes recreationally, but rarely as an addictive substance. And you can ingest tobacco. It's a purgative. If you're having stomach ailments, it can really help cleanse the system. A lot of tribes also in South America ingest tobacco for the digestive system. You can also make a poultice about it to reduce inflammation and swelling. Say if you get stung by a bee or you have some kind of bruise or abrasion.
Uh-huh.
So it can be used topically. It can be used orally. We use it as an offering. to the spirit world. Say we go and gather wild strawberries, we don't just take without giving something back. That's the law of reciprocity. So we're gathering wild strawberries and we use tobacco as an offering to put back into the land to replenish the soil and to thank the spirits of the strawberry for giving their life to us. It's also most famously and kind of stereotypically used in the peace pipe. That was real. My own tribe, the Anishinaabe or the Ojibwe or the Chippewa, our word for let us smoke and making an agreement or a treaty is the same word. So for us, when we exchanged breath through the pipe, you didn't inhale deep into your lungs. It was more like people smoke the pipe, you know, recreationally, just in your mouth. When you share that breath of that smoke going up to Creator, Creator is a witness of whatever we say to each other. So for us, it's like signing a treaty when you smoke something together. So that is a real tradition that still persists today with things like the Buffalo Treaty that just has been signed by a number of First Nations between US and Canada to open up land so that the buffalo can return and be restored to their landscape. And many of the tribes, the leaders smoke the pipe in agreement as really a responsibility to the buffalo or whatever you're agreeing to. So many different stories about when tobacco came to us from the Creator as a medicine to clear the mind, to make agreements, to make offerings back to Mother Earth, and when needed to use as a physical medicine, topically, orally, or ingesting it. So there's a lot of power to tobacco.
Yeah, who would have known, right?
Who would have known? And then what right. the cigarette company did to it, you know, it was during the early colonial stage. It was like, let's turn this into an addictive substance, right? And that's that was never the intent. Just like coca leaves, the same thing in the Andes, the tribes have been using coca leaves for centuries in the high altitudes. They're you chew them, it clears your headaches when you have altitude sickness, reduces nausea, gives you a little energy or endurance to keep going in those high mountains, but non-addictive. But whenever you turn something into a white powder, look out.
Anyway, we're just about out of time, but this has been so wonderful and so informative, and I'm so happy that there's people like you out there sharing your knowledge and wisdom with everybody so that we become more conscious and more aware of the need for
reciprocity.
You know, it's just so needed. And I just thank you so much for your work.
Well, thank you, Bhavani. I really appreciate your work too. And I eat green and look forward to keeping in touch. So
thank you
for listening.
Bye. Thank you. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you so much. Please, you know, consider donating to this wonderful organization, the Cultural Conservancy. And I will see you all again next week. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.